Good evening for WBAI News in New York. I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. We've seen this scenario before. The U.S. and Russia are trading conflicting assertions about who launched a chemical weapons attack in Syria on Tuesday. It killed 72 people, including children. It injured more than 300. The White House says Syrian President Bashar Assad's government is responsible for the chemical weapons attack in Syria. Russia, however, says anti-Assad rebels are to blame. Donald Trump, however, at a news conference today with Jordan's president at the White House, didn't cast blame on Assad or Russia. Instead, he used his well-worn Trump punching bag, Barack Obama.
The Obama administration had a great opportunity to solve this crisis a long time ago when he said the red line in the sand. And when he didn't cross that line after making the threat, I think that set us back a long ways, not only in Syria, but in many other parts of the world, because it was a blank threat. I think it was something that was not one of our better days as a country.
Trump says his attitude has changed since the chemical attack.
And if you look back over the last few weeks, there were other attacks using gas. You're now talking about a whole different level. So, as you know, I would love to have never been in the Middle East. I would love to have never seen that whole big situation start. But once it started, we got out the wrong way, and ISIS formed in the vacuum, and lots of bad things happened. I will tell you, what happened yesterday is unacceptable to me.
But Trump wouldn't tell reporters his plan for dealing with Syria or coordinating with Russia if there is a plan. He said this:
militarily, I don't like to say where I'm going and what I'm doing.
Officials say Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, is going to discuss Syria with Russian leaders next week when he visits Moscow. It's the first announced visit by a top U.S. official to Russia since Trump's inauguration. Russia's military says the chemicals were dispersed when Syrian warplanes bombed a facility where rebels were building chemical weapons. The attack was in a Syrian town in Idlib province. It's about 70 hours away from the Turkish border. Syrian opposition activists described the attack as among the worst in the country's six-year civil war. At a donor conference in Brussels today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed for Syria's warring factions and government backers such as Russia and Iran to bring an end to the six-year conflict, which has killed almost 400,000 people. The UN Secretary General:
nobody is winning this war. Everybody is losing. It puts a danger to us all. And the fight against terrorism is vital. But any successes will be ephemeral without a political solution to the crisis in Syria.
Nearly half the Syrian population has been displaced by violence, with millions seeking sanctuary in neighboring Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, or heading further west to Europe. UN agencies estimate war damage across Syria so far at $350 billion, including physical destruction and the loss of economic activity. Four out of five people are living in poverty in Syria. Gutierrez says behind these figures lies a gradual draining of hope and a turn towards despair that we must resolve. Also today, the UN Security Council held an emergency session midday on the attack. They heard from the UN representative for OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Deanne Penn reports.
The attack reportedly occurred on Tuesday in the Khan Sheikhoun area of Idlib in northwestern Syria. UN Disarmament Chief Kim Won-soo told ambassadors that he has been in close contact with the OPCW Director General since reports first surfaced.
He informed me that OPCW fact-finding mission is actively engaged in gathering and analyzing information from all available sources and will be prepared to deploy a team at the earliest opportunity. If confirmed, this would constitute the single largest chemical weapons attack in the Syrian Arab Republic since the attack in eastern Ghouta in August 2013.
That attack 4 years ago killed hundreds of people in an area outside Syria's capital, Damascus. Nikki Haley is the United States ambassador to the UN.
We cannot close our eyes to those pictures. We cannot close our minds of the responsibility to act. We don't yet know everything about yesterday's attack, but there are many things we do know. We know that yesterday's attack bears all the hallmarks of the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons. We know that Assad had used these weapons against the Syrian people before. That was confirmed by this council's own independent team of investigators. We know that yesterday's attack was a new low, even for the barbaric Assad regime.
Mr. Kim, the UN official, said reports indicated that the attack in Idlib was carried out through an airstrike on a residential area, although details are still emerging. Syrian Deputy Ambassador Monzur Monzur stated that his country has never used chemical weapons against its people. He spoke through an interpreter.
We categorically reject false claims and accusations on the use of the Syrian Arab army of toxic chemicals against Syrian civilians in Khan Sheikhoun. These are used as human shields by the armed terrorist groups. Syria also reaffirms that the Syrian Arab army does not have any form or type of chemical weapons. We have never used them and we will never use them.
Russia also expressed its opposition to the use of these weapons. Here's the country's UN Deputy Representative, Vladimir Safrankov, also speaking through an interpreter.
What is clear to us is that chemical terrorism is increasing and it needs to be countered as decisively as possible. Unfortunately, all our attempts over the past 3 years to get the Security Council to react to the crimes of terrorists who are using chemical weapons more and more frequently have not led to success due to the opposition of Western colleagues.
The United Kingdom regretted that ambassadors had failed to adopt a resolution in February which would have imposed sanctions for chemical weapons use in Syria. Matthew Rycroft is the UK ambassador to the United Nations.
We could have sent a clear message that day. A clear signal that there would be consequences for using these horrific weapons, for violating international law. A clear signal that there was Security Council unity, global unity, against any use of these weapons. But after Russia and China vetoed, it seems that the only message sent to Assad was one of encouragement. And yesterday, we saw the consequences of those vetoes.
UK Ambassador Matthew Rycroft speaking during the UN Security Council debate on the suspected chemical weapons attack this week in Syria. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Medical staff and facilities in Idlib in Syria are overwhelmed. They are short of life-saving medicines after the deadly chemical attack. WHO spokesperson Tariq Jasarovic says his agency is responding to the attack as best they can. They've been prepared for chemical attacks which have occurred in the past.
What we are hearing is that around 50 people have been transferred to Turkey and being treated there. These health facilities in the area of Idlib have been targeted in the past. We know that many of them do not function properly. We do have regular supplies through the network of partners who are supporting hospitals in this part of Syria. So we do normally send medical supplies, including medicines and protective equipment, in case the use of chemical agents takes place, because we know that in Syria there were many reports since 2012 of the use of chemical agents, and some of them have been proved by the Office of the Convention of Chemical Weapons, who did the investigation, that it indeed took place. So this is why WHO has been working in Syria, as well as it has been working in Iraq in the past couple of years, to prepare health systems through training, through hospital preparedness, through provision of medicines and medical equipment, protective equipment, also making available guidelines for health workers on treatment of consequences of exposure to chemical agents.
WHO World Health Organization spokesperson Tariq Jasarovic. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Also today, the Senate continued its deliberation on Donald Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch. Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon held the Senate floor for 15 hours. He began last night shortly after 6 and concluded this morning at around 10:15 a.m. He highlighted his party's opposition to Gorsuch. Here's Senator Merkley after 15 hours saying the Supreme Court seat would be stolen unless it goes to Barack Obama's pick, Merrick Garland.
So let me return to where I started yesterday evening, which we are facing three very significant problems. The first problem is that for the first time in history, we are considering a nominee for a stolen Supreme Court seat. And that alone should be reason for everyone who cares about this institution to turn down this nominee and to convey to the president that the only legitimate nominee for this open seat is Merrick Garland, because as a Senate, we have a stake in the legitimacy of our work and that of the court. And to confirm anyone but Merrick Garland to this seat confirms the Senate as the thief who took the seat for the first time in U.S. history and transported to another president in an effort to pack the court. And furthermore, if there is a person confirmed to the seat other than Merrick Garland, it casts a shadow over every 5-4 decision that individual participates in the years to come. It destroys the public credibility of the position. It makes the Supreme Court simply into a political body to which clever campaign tactics have delivered a majority for one ideological vision over another. Let us not enter into that position of destroying the credibility of the Senate process and the integrity of the court in one fell swoop. And second of all, we should not be considering a nominee from a president who is under investigation for conspiring with Russia to change the outcome of an election. Now, we don't know where those investigations will lead, but what we do know is this places a big cloud over the legitimacy of him holding the office. Let us clear up that cloud. Let us answer the questions that have been raised when a week ago Monday, FBI Director Comey came to Capitol Hill to talk to the House and say, yes, those investigations are underway. And we know what the diabolical practices of the Russians were. We know that they created fake news. We know that they had a team of roughly 1,000 people sending out contrived social media messages to comment on the events of the day to make it look like American citizens were commenting and to make one candidate look very good and the other candidate look very bad. And finally, this is an extreme nominee from the far right who doesn't believe in the fundamental vision of we the people and makes decision after decision through tortured, twisted, contrived arguments to find for the powerful over the people. And that is unacceptable. Thank you, Mr. President.
Merkley was followed by Republican Senate Majority Leader from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell. He blames far-left ideology for division over the Gorsuch nomination.
Judge Neil Gorsuch is one of the most impressive nominees we've ever seen. If a widely praised nominee like this can't get past a Democratic filibuster, then no nominee of a Republican president could. Democrats would filibuster Ruth Bader Ginsburg if President Trump nominated her. We all know why. The Democrats are bowing to hard-left special interests that can't get over the results of the election and thus are demanding complete Democratic opposition to everything this president touches. And as the Washington Post just reported, the Democratic leaders seem ready to endorse every argument the activists have made. It seems some Democrats made up their minds long ago to oppose whomever the president nominated. The Democratic leader himself indicated as much before Judge Gorsuch was even selected. He even mused on a liberal talk show about holding the seat open indefinitely. So it doesn't really matter who this president nominates. A Democratic minority is determined to successfully launch an unprecedented partisan filibuster regardless. Perhaps that's why Democrats still have yet to put forward a cogent rationale to oppose him. Not that that would be easy, you understand. As a longtime Democrat and board member of the left-leaning American Constitution Society put it, the Senate should confirm Justice Gorsuch because there is no principal reason to vote no. Well, if there's no principal reason to vote no on this nomination, then there's certainly no principal reason to prevent the Senate from taking a vote on it at all. But that's just what a partisan Democratic minority of the Senate is threatening to do. For the first time in nearly 230-year history of the Senate.
Neil Gorsuch was selected by the so-called alt-right, the Koch brothers-backed Heritage Foundation, and the Federalist Society, financed by the Mercer family, backers of Breitbart, Steve Bannon, and Donald Trump's presidential campaign. We can't forget how Donald Trump came to the decision to pick Neil Gorsuch, says Senator Ed Markey on the Senate floor today. He's a Democrat from Massachusetts.
President Trump went to two of the most partisan conservative organizations which he could find, the Koch brothers-supported Heritage Foundation and the right-wing Federalist Society, and said to them, who do you want on the Supreme Court? And they compiled their dream team of 21 ultra-conservative candidates. President Trump looked at the names on that list and asked himself which judge could pass the right-wing litmus test he had articulated during the campaign. His choice was Judge Neil Gorsuch. On the campaign trail, candidate Donald Trump made clear that he was pro-life and would appoint pro-life judges to the Supreme Court. In one interview, he was asked about his pro-life position as follows. Here's the question posed to him. So, how important is that issue to you now? When President Trump picks the Supreme Court justices, would there be a litmus test? Trump responded, quote, it is. During the second presidential debate, candidate Trump doubled down on this issue. He was asked specifically about Roe versus Wade, the longstanding Supreme Court precedent establishing a woman's right to choose. The question to candidate Trump was, quote, do you want the court, including the justices that you will name, to overturn Roe versus Wade? Trump responded that he would, quote, be appointing pro-life judges, adding, well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that will happen, meaning Roe versus Wade will be overturned. So we know from Donald Trump's own words that he had a litmus test for Supreme Court nominees on a woman's right to choose. And that litmus test is that he will appoint only pro-life justices who are committed to overturning Roe versus Wade. What about a litmus test on guns? Well, during the presidential campaign, candidate Trump repeatedly emphasized his pro-gun views, which are in lockstep with the National Rifle Association. He was asked about a litmus test for the Second Amendment, specifically the precedent established in the 2008 Supreme Court case of District of Columbia versus Heller. In Heller, the justices ruled 5-4 that a common sense Washington, D.C. law banning handguns and requiring other firearms to be stored, unloaded, or locked violated the Second Amendment. Candidate Trump was asked, quote, will you make upholding the Heller decision a litmus test in Supreme Court nominees? Trump answered, quote, yes, I would. The follow-up question, so you won't nominate somebody to the Supreme Court unless they agree with Scalia on the Heller decision? Trump responded, quote, correct. So we know from Donald Trump's own words that he had a litmus test for Supreme Court nominees on guns. His judges must support the National Rifle Association's agenda and its unreasonable and dangerously broad view of the Second Amendment. So, from that list of 21 provided to him by the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society, President Trump chose Judge Neil Gorsuch, apparently convinced that he was the man who would pass these litmus tests.
Markey says there's much we don't know about Gorsuch, but there is much we do know.
If the first 75 days of the Trump administration are a preview of coming attractions, one thing could not be more clear. The United States Supreme Court's rule defending the Constitution will be tested as never before. Conflicts of interest, emoluments, Muslim bans, rescinding LGBTQ protections, the list of constitutional rights the Trump administration is violating gets longer every single day. Now, more than ever, we need a Supreme Court justice who is independent and not beholden to ideology. Now, more than ever, we need a justice who will stand up for the rights of all Americans against big corporate interests. A justice who would be to the right of Antonin Scalia on the issue of Chevron deference is not a mainstream justice. A justice who would be to the right of Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas by a substantial margin, as professors from Michigan State University and the University of Wisconsin concluded, examining Judge Gorsuch's opinions from the Tenth Circuit and the Supreme Court's decisions reviewing them, is not someone within the mainstream of American jurisprudence. Everything that we have seen so far, from Donald Trump's judicial litmus test to the visible hand of right-wing interest groups in the selection process, to Judge Gorsuch's reluctance before the Judiciary Committee, to his pro-corporate bias in cases he has decided, leads me to the conclusion that he will be neither a justice for all Americans nor one on whom we can count to stand up to President Trump. We cannot let Judge Neil Gorsuch become the crucial ninth vote on the Supreme Court. One justice matters. The list of recent 5-4 decisions coming out of the Supreme Court shows that one judge's vote can forever alter history. Just remember that Bush versus Gore, Citizens United, District of Columbia versus Heller, the Affordable Care Act were all decided by 5-4 votes. I will, therefore, oppose Judge Gorsuch to the Supreme Court and support the filibuster. And I urge my colleagues to do so as well.
Senator Markey says if Judge Gorsuch cannot get to the 60 votes needed for confirmation, it's not the process, it's the nominee. And Markey urges Donald Trump to withdraw the nominee.
My name is Bob Master, and I am the co-chair of the New York Working Families Party and also the political director for the Communications Workers of America in New York, New Jersey, and New England. The people of this country really don't accept the values that Neil Gorsuch embodies. We believe that he represents a threat to women's rights, to voting rights, to the rights of workers, to the rights of LGBTQ people. And, you know, he is consistently taking the side of the wealthy and corporations against average people. The Democrats right now have the votes to filibuster Gorsuch. The question is whether or not the Republicans will do, unfortunately, what they've been doing for years, which is, you know, simply stepping outside the norms of political behavior in this country and ignoring the rules, trampling on the rules. We know that they stole a Supreme Court seat last year from Barack Obama. They refused even to consider the nomination of Merrick Garland. McConnell said, my main objective is for Barack Obama to fail. So they're capable of eliminating the filibuster rule. I think that's possible. On the other hand, there are some Republican senators who understand that one day they're going to be in the minority too, again, and may vote to protect the filibuster. So it's hard to tell, but, what we have to do is fight, and we're going to fight every step of the way. We saw in the last couple of weeks an amazing victory of the people against Trump and the Republicans on the Health Care Act. The ACA is not perfect. We prefer a better system with getting the insurance companies out and making Medicare available to everybody and so on. But, nobody really believed that we would be able to defeat the repeal of ACA. And that happened because people by the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands, turned out at town meetings, lobbied, called, picketed their members of Congress, and they couldn't resist it.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
Show me what resistance looks like.
This is what resistance looks like.
Show me what persistence looks like.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. The news was produced with Deanne Penn, Ekam Killick, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.